So today, our speaker is going to be Nick Everett, who is a person who is... Sorry, I just realised I had... he's a good guy. He's done quite a bit of research about anti-fascism in Australia, which is the topic for today. So we'll take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Vashti. Well, writing in 1934, the British fascist Oswald Mosley declared, "It was remarkable that Australia, without having studied political philosophy and methods, spontaneously developed a fascism peculiarly suited to the needs of the British Empire." Mosley was perhaps echoing a widely held myth that Australia is a classless society built from egalitarian foundations. However, Mosley's observation is not so remarkable when one considers the class backgrounds of Australia's interwar fascist and proto-fascist leaders and their close connections to the Australian ruling elite. Well, Australia's interwar far-right movement gained momentum in the aftermath of World War I and took on the character of a mass movement at the height of the Depression in 1931-1932. At its core were loyalists of the British Empire, who had served as Australia's Imperial Force officers in the Great War on the battlefields of Turkey and Palestine and on the Western Front, men who championed King and Empire and despised Bolsheviks and Irish Republicans. Between 1916 and 1919, their born-to-rule confidence was shaken by a series of domestic and international challenges. On the domestic front, the Billy Hughes government's efforts to introduce conscription... The Billy Hughes government's efforts to introduce conscription floundered in two referenda in 1916 and 1917. The Australian anti-conscription campaign achieved a remarkable coalition of forces, including the International Workers of the World, trade unionists, socialists, most of the Labor Party, and the Catholic Church. Much to the chagrin of Hughes, the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, Daniel Mannix, denounced the war as a sordid trade war. In late 1917, amidst growing discontent with Hughes' pro-war policies, the nation was gripped by a strike wave. Started by engineers in tramway workshops in New South Wales, it soon escalated into a mass nationwide strike involving nearly 100,000 workers. The strike ended in defeat. The large-scale mobilisation of scab labour and strikebreakers by the government was crucial to this outcome. However, the result was not a foregone conclusion. Capitalist politicians recognised the need to avail themselves of the state machinery, in the final instance a body of armed men, to paraphrase Marx, to suppress widespread labour militancy. Compounding ruling class fear of a combative anti-war labour movement were two international events. The first was the 1916 uprising in Dublin, brutally suppressed by British troops, and the second was the October 1917 Russian Revolution. The former reinforced an Australian ruling class fear of disloyalty among Australia's large Catholic Irish emigre population. The latter, leading to the formation of the Communist Party of Australia, further fuelled the far right's paranoia. The federal government's response, a raft of draconian legislation and secret enlistment of a paramilitary strike force, provided a foundation around which the far right could organise. Opposition to Bolshevism and loyalty to King and Empire provided the ideological glue that bound this movement together. Returned servicemen provided the stormtroopers, organised by the Returned Soldiers and Sailors Imperial League of Australia, RSSILA, later the Returned Services League. It wasn't called the RSL until after World War II, but we'll just use that name for the sake of convenience. Now, I'm stressing here that this body was from the outset dominated by the officer caste that I referred to in my introduction. The far right's repression and intimidation of the union movement and the left, its support for authoritarianism and even dictatorship were qualities the Australian far right shared with European fascism. Nonetheless, the Australian far right also had its own unique characteristics, reflective of its British colonial settler origins. This talk will examine how the far right capitalised on the heightened conflict brought on by the Great Depression, and how in particular its role in unseating the Lang Labor government in 1932. I'll also discuss the response of the Communist Party of Australia and Lang Labor to this crisis. It'll be argued that while Lang's dismissal offered a constitutional solution to the ruling class's crisis, or an ostensibly constitutional solution, and the rapid demobilisation of an explicitly fascist organisation, the New Guard, Australia's far right was not defeated in the Depression years. Rather, its leaders found political homes within the conservative United Australia Party governments that came to power federally and in New South Wales. These governments implemented much of the right-wing paramilitary organisation's agenda, attacking free speech and undermining democratic rights, as well as an austerity agenda that attacked working-class living standards and restored capitalist profitability. Well, Bolshevik leader Leon Trotsky, analysing the rise of Mussolini's fascist movement in Italy, argued that fascism is distinguished from all other forms of bourgeois reaction by relying not simply on police state methods of repression, but rather by recruiting the petty bourgeoisie, the shopkeepers, peasants, small business people and state functionaries, and the lumpen backward elements of the working class into a mass movement to demoralise, intimidate and crush the workers' movement. Writing during the rise of fascism in Germany, Trotsky argued for mobilising a determined working class fight back against the forces of fascism, in contrast to the more passive resistance offered by the German Communist Party, the KPD, and the Social Democratic Party. In Australia, as in Germany and Italy, returned troops were a key recruiting ground for the far-right movement. However, explicitly fascist forces, and I'm going to talk here a lot about the New Guard, were outnumbered by more established far-right forces, such as the Old Guard in New South Wales and the White Army in Victoria, which were more closely tied to the state, big business and the establishment. The enlistment of special constables, a citizen's army, to suppress labour militancy in times of crisis was not a new tactic for the Australian ruling class. The Sydney Police Act of 1855 provided for such measures in the event that any tumult had taken place or may be reasonably apprehended. In the 1890 maritime strike, thousands of special constables were recruited into the New South Wales Police Force to repress rebellious workers. The government and its strikebreakers emerged victorious, emboldening the ruling class's determination to stamp out working class political and industrial activity. Even as Labor turned towards electoralism and arbitration, it was seen as an affront to the establishment party's sense of entitlement. In 1891, the Sydney Morning Herald declared, "Our greatest peril comes from the intrusion of the labour struggle into the field of politics, which would bring social strife and extreme bitterness and violence." In 1918, the Australian Protective League was formed, inspired by the American Protection League. The APL's purpose was to coordinate the country's best citizens into paramilitary squads ready to assist with the maintenance of law and order when called upon to do so. The League, headed up by Melbourne industrialist Herbert Brooks, carried out surveillance on so-called enemy activities. Its leaders included solicitors, academics and aldermen, and it had close connections with the acting Prime Minister, the Defence Minister, top spies and military figures, as well as influential Melbourne capitalists. The establishment of the Special Investigations Branch in 1919 served to strengthen connections between the state and paramilitary groups, which shared a common interest in surveillance and suppression of the left. As historian Andrew Moore observes, Australia's 1920s far-right militias were in essence civilian auxiliaries linked to government through the Commonwealth Investigation Branch. The Australian Legion, for example, a strongly anti-communist group modelled on Italian fascism, had close links with John Latham, an ex-military intelligence officer who held the post of Attorney General in the Conservative Bruce government. Such connections offered legal and political protection. While these paramilitary forces claim the mantle of being defensive units aimed at maintaining law and order, their practice was more that of vigilantes. The Red Flag riots, the subject of a talk in the last session, provides an example. In Brisbane in March and April 1919, right-wing militias engaged in 4 weeks of street fighting, laying siege to the Russian Club and storming the offices of the Labour newspaper, the Daily Standard, in retaliation for a trade union parade carrying the red flag, then punishable under the provisions of the Sedition Act. I'll call it the RSL here, mobilised some 2,000 rioters composed primarily of returned soldiers. A similar provocation, one on a much larger scale, took place in Sydney in 1921. More than 100,000 vigilantes mobilised from across Sydney and rural New South Wales, brutally attacking speakers from the Socialist Labour Party, the Communist Party and the returned soldiers section of the Labour Party at the Domain. One nearly got his eye gouged out. However, it was the 1923 Victorian police strike that provided the impetus for a significant expansion and coordination of a reactionary citizens' army. Unable to suppress strike action by the very forces tasked with maintaining law and order, the Victorian police, the state premier assembled a citizens' committee charged with the responsibility of marshalling the resources of the community to meet an emergency. A special constabulary force, led by Lieutenant General John Monash, assembled 6,000 men, nearly 10 times the number of police on strike, under arms. Again, this militia force was composed primarily of returned servicemen, but prominent within it were, and I quote, leading commercial and professional men, as well as some interstate graziers in town for the Melbourne Cup, according to the Argus newspaper. And those interstate graziers probably no doubt brought with them countrymen, who were British loyalists. The special constables hospitalised 200 so-called rioters on the night before the Melbourne Cup. Their show of force ultimately defeated the strike. While Monash's special constabulary force was officially disbanded in May 1924, it set an important precedent for future secret enlistment of special forces. One such legacy was the creation of the White Army, a covert volunteer force with close connections to state security. Its successor, the League for National Security, the LNS, emerged as the largest far-right organisation in Victoria during the 1930s, with an estimated membership of 30,000 in 1931. Its key leaders were drawn from the Melbourne establishment. They included figures such as Colonel F.P. Durham, a solicitor, director of several Melbourne companies, and future Major General. Sir Edmund Herring, subsequently Chief Justice of the Victorian Supreme Court, and then Lieutenant Governor of Victoria, and Sir Thomas Blaney, the Victorian Police Commissioner, who later commanded the Australian Army in World War II. In March 1931, the LNS, terrified by rumours of a march on Melbourne by the unemployed, leading to an uprising by a coalition of communists and Irish Catholics, mounted a coordinated military action throughout much of rural Victoria to crush the disloyalists. Thousands of heavily armed, loyal, respectable citizens were mobilised to seize control of dozens of towns. That picture behind you is from the Melbourne police strike that I mentioned earlier. The LNS functioned as an umbrella for a fraternal collection of far-right organisations across the country. In 1931 and 1932, every state had its own far-right organisation. These included the Citizens League of South Australia, the West Australian Liberation League, the New States movements in Riverina and New England, districts of New South Wales, and the more infamous New Guard. The most pervasive, secretive, but respectable of all was the Old Guard, the New South Wales equivalent of the LNS, which had close connections with the police, the armed forces, and the security apparatus. The Old Guard never actually referred to it itself as the Old Guard. It was simply known as the movement within its secretive circles. But the name caught on because of the split from the Old Guard that formed the New Guard that referred, perhaps in derogatory fashion, to the more oldie crusty members of the movement as the old guard. So the origins of this force, the old guard, was a special task force called the X-Force, commissioned by the Bruce government. In 1925, Major Jack Scott was tasked with recruiting 500 men who could meet a large-scale working-class demonstration opposing the deportation of Walsh and Johnson. These two trade unionists had been the key leaders of the seamen's strike earlier that year. The government was unsuccessful in its deportation efforts after being challenged in the courts. However, the X-Force was later replaced by a more permanent far-right militia, essentially the Old Guard, of which Major Jack Scott was the chief of staff. The Old Guard's leadership read like a who's who of the Sydney establishment. It included figures such as Sydney banker Alfred Davidson, Philip Goldfinch, general manager of CSR, a major Australian company, and Sir Samuel Horden, president of the Royal Agricultural Society and chairman of the AMP. These were powerful men who were prepared to abandon bourgeois democracy for a dictatorship of the wealthy or a committee of capable men, as they expressed it. The Old Guard built a militia force of some 40,000 men, largely ex-soldiers and farmers in almost every town in rural New South Wales. As well as a secret military wing, it had an open front organisation called the All Australia League, which boasted 130,000 members soon after its formation in 1931. And to say something about its class composition, I've talked about its leadership, but it drew heavily on RSL branches in rural country towns. It fared much worse in terms of drawing from the urban population in Sydney, but it certainly did encompass a section of the middle class and more wealthy Sydney business community. The far-right organisations described here gained prominence and strength amidst the sharp class polarisation engendered by the Depression. Massive unemployment, comparable to that of Germany, provided the catalyst for a rapid growth of both the far-left and the far-right, as workers grew increasingly angry at their lot and the ruling class began to fear of an open class revolt. In 1929, a massive fall in the price of exports and a drying up of international credit made it difficult for Australian investors to repay the overseas loans which had funded much of the expansion of the 1920s. Employers attempted to shift the cost of the credit crisis onto workers, resulting in three major industrial battles in 1928 and 1929. Each ended in defeat for the workers. The employers' first offensive began on the waterfront in 1928. Striking wharfies were shot down by police on the Melbourne wharves and their union crushed. Next in line were the timber workers. After a 9-month strike involving police violence and arrest of strikers, the workers returned on the boss's terms. Then the miners on the northern New South Wales coalfields were locked out for 16 months, eventually being defeated by strike breaking and repression. A miner at Rothery was shot dead by police. The defeat of these key sections of the union movement, combined with high unemployment, 30% of the workforce by 1931, produced a mood of bitterness and resentment. In 1929, James Scullin was elected as Prime Minister, promising to end the lockout in the coal industry and to ease the burden of unemployment. Scullin was a Labor Party man. The Bank of England feared a default on debts owed by Australia and in 1930 sent an envoy, Sir Otto Nymier, to lecture Australian governments on the virtues of austerity and belt tightening. However, they needn't have bothered. Scullin readily accepted that profits and investor confidence trump the welfare of workers. State and federal governments slashed government spending, cancelled public works and cut public service salaries and welfare benefits by 20%. The arbitration court cut all other wages by 10%. Well, the New South Wales Labor Premier, Jack Lang, attacked the federal government for its capitulation to foreign banking. Lang was what today might be termed a populist. He had no principled left-wing agenda, but rather employed anti-capitalist and anti-elite rhetoric to maintain the support of Labor's working class constituency. The Lang plan proposed to suspend interest payments on foreign debts, lower interest rates, and take the currency off the gold standard. So the Lang Labor basically stood out from the rest of the Labor governments. I think there were, by this time, Labor state governments in all of the mainland states who went along with the federal government's premier's plan. Lang's defiance, though short-lived, indicated something much deeper. The Depression, with its mass unemployment, evictions, savage wage cuts, deep misery, even starvation, meant that vast numbers of workers saw capitalism having failed. At a union conference in Sydney in April 1930, 300 delegates heard from Trades Hall Secretary Jock Garden that the present conspiracy of the capitalist class and its politicians is aimed at the rationalisation of industry, thereby creating a huge army of unemployed and starving workers. The delegates demanded that the unemployed be excused from paying rent and landlords be discouraged from evicting them. Inside the Labor Party, the political climate swung sharply to the left. Members began to demand that the socialist objective of the Labor Party be taken seriously, and socialisation units were established to carry the message of a saner, better and more efficient social system through socialisation to those hundreds of thousands of misguided victims of capitalism. At its height, 178 of the 250 Labor branches around Sydney had active units, with a newspaper, the Socialisation Call, education classes and a theatre group and its own orchestra. In this context, that's a picture from Melbourne, actually, of a unemployed workers' march in 1931. All right, so in this context, the Communist Party propaganda about the final crisis of capitalism and the urgent need for a revolution struck a chord. At the start of 1930, they had 300 members. By 1934, there were nearly 3,000. The party's paper, Workers' Weekly, had sales of about 2,000 in 1928, but this had risen to 10,000 by 1931. The Communist Party argued that a system that had thrown so many workers onto the scrap heap deserved to be swept away and replaced with a socialist society. To achieve that, workers had to break with the reformist Labor Party and build a genuine revolutionary party. The Communist Party threw itself into activity in support of the miners' and timber workers' strikes. In 1930, it initiated the unemployed workers' movement, and by 1934, this movement claimed 68,000 members in the eastern states. The Communist Party was also at the centre of resistance to the immediate effects of the Depression. While there were other movements, organisations of the unemployed created by the Labor Party and the Trades Hall Councils, the UWM outstripped those in terms of size and activity. It led eviction battles, fights to defend free speech, demonstrations, dole strikes and campaigns for relief works to provide jobs. The Communist Party was at the centre of various battles against evictions. The Sydney Morning Herald described how the most sensational battle Sydney had ever known was fought between 40 policemen and 18 communists in Newtown, Sydney, in June 1931. Perhaps a bit of exaggeration there. And it describes how entrenched behind barbed wire and sandbags, the defenders rained stones weighing several pounds onto the heads of the attacking police who were attempting to execute an eviction order. A crowd hostile to the police, numbering many thousands, threatened to become out of hand. When constables emerged from the back of buildings with their faces covered in blood, the crowd hooted and shouted insulting remarks. However, the forces of reaction did not stand by passively, but actively prepared a counter-offensive against both the communists and Lang Labor, which they perceived as destabilising and a Trojan horse for communist influence. Lang's plan incensed the bourgeoisie. They soon demanded his removal. The Melbourne Herald declared, "Today in New South Wales, the deliberate process of smashing is going on under our noses. Sovietization and revolution have found their instrument in Lang. Well, a little bit of exaggeration there too. So the new guard, which, as I said, it's split from the old guard, advocated an openly for a coup d'etat to overthrow the Lang Labour government and institute a dictatorship. Its units physically attacked union, labour, unemployed and communist meetings. The old guard, reflecting more powerful financial interests, sought to impose a capital strike to the same ends. Its secretive military units served more as a reserve army for the capitalist state. While the new guard, with its middle-class base, was more classically fascist, both organisations loyally served ruling class interests. The leader of the new guard was Eric Campbell, who came from elite stock and married into a privileged family, a rural pastoral family based in Young. Writing in 1934 in his manifesto, The New Road, Campbell lamented, "There are plenty of people of good birth and high standards in Australia, but they are not a class, regulating their actions by a code of behaviour and therefore have but little influence. The remnants of the descendants of the cultured and elegant class that graced the colony when it was an infant state are to a large extent scattered through the warp and woof of community. Politically, the spirit of our institutions has been destroyed by the extension of the franchise and the progressive growth of the party system. I do not suggest the extension of the franchise is unjust. On the contrary, I believe every citizen has the right to express himself politically in the ration of his national importance. The disadvantage lies in the fact that it has turned the careful choice of rulers into mob impulse." So here a thorough lack of confidence in the capacity of the system really to serve the capitalist interests, a system where a majority could impose its will on the ruling class through its own political institutions. The New Guard emerged less as a reaction to the Depression and more as a response to the Lang Labor government, which was seen to be impinging on property rights. Campbell sought to do what the old guard and the LNS had not done to date and come out into the open, providing a rallying point for far-right elements. And this took place in two successive Sydney Town Hall meetings, each numbering about 3,000. The first on the 22nd of July 1931, attended by 3,000 men and four women, Lang demanded a government that championed liberal economic policies that would reduce taxation to the barest minimum, reduce the public services down to nothing, run state services such as railways and post offices as business concerns, and abolish the right to dole payments. Much of that would sound familiar to people here. In fact, John Howard's father, Lyle Howard, I think, a petrol station owner in Sydney, was a member of the New Guard at this time. The second meeting was held on the 16th of September 1931, and Campbell made himself plain, declaring, "We made his message plain, I should say. Were we forced by a condition of chaos to temporarily assume control of the state, the re-establishment of law and order could only be regarded as the first step. Before the country would be ready again to form democratic government, it would be our duty to secure the lawful appointment during this period of time of a limited number of men of sincerity, strength, skills and courage, and invest them with the administration of the country." The meeting ended as the previous one had, with renditions of Advance Australia Fair, not then the national anthem, but a favourite in Australian right-wing circles, Land of Hope and Glory, and the then national anthem, God Save the Queen. This second meeting also finished with the singing of the Song of the New Guard, and I was going to give you a rendition, but I'm probably a bit short on time.
We've got plenty of time. Go for it.
Okay.
So enough time for this.
The chorus goes like this. "We of the New Guard, and always on the ready, in case of danger in our midst, we'll all be firm and steady. So when we get our orders, we'll make our voices ring. I'm a loyal guardsman, one of the guards. God save our king. Guards, God save our king. Oh. And on it goes. All right, where was I?
We've got a good voice. Boo.
The next morning, the Conservative press praised Campbell's words. As historian Keith Amos observes, the new guard, in its early stage of development, had developed several proto-fascist traits. It was intoxicated with an Anglo-Australian patriotic ideology. It was secretly armed, drilled and organised to a degree that gave it the capacity to attempt to take control of the state. It was authoritarian in its own structure and equivocal in its attitude towards the processes of parliamentary democracy, putting it mildly. Over the coming months, the new guard engaged in a series of provocations in an effort to prepare for the ousting of the Lang Labor government and to suppress any resistance that might be offered by the Labor movement. In October 1931, it threatened to intervene in a shipping strike that had resulted from an attempt to reduce seamen's wages by 10%. This intervention was viewed as counterproductive by the employers and denounced by a 500-strong meeting of representatives from the unions, labour branches and the unemployed, and never eventuated. Over the summer of 1931-32, the new guard proceeded with what Campbell described as a program of civil disobedience. Rallies were held within the leafy, well-to-do suburbs of Sydney in preparation for a mass delegation to Governor Philip Game's office, where a petition was to be delivered, allegedly bearing 400,000 signatures, demanding Lang's sacking. On the 13th of February, 500 new guardsmen drilled in Belmore Park. That's just opposite Sydney Central Station, for those not familiar with Sydney. And on the 26th of February, 200 guardsmen in 40 cars descended on a Bankstown meeting of the unemployed workers' movement. They were forced to beat a retreat when faced with resistance from communists and opposition, actually, from New South Wales police as well. In Darlinghurst, then a working-class suburb, new Guard Commander Francis de Groot, a former British Army cavalry captain, directed goon squads to attack meetings of the left. In April 1932, the new Guard organised a riot outside Sydney's Central Police Station as a trial run for a coup. It went badly, and I won't go into all the details here, but basically Sir Philip Game, the New South Wales Governor, acceded to the demands not just of the new guard but the old guard and Sydney's establishment by sacking Lang on the 13th of May. And soon after, the Scullin Federal Labor Government also fell. Lang's dismissal and subsequent electoral defeat preempted Campbell's planned seizure of power and deprived the organisation of its raison d'etre. With economic conditions gradually improving, the new guard became superfluous. The capitalist crisis had been averted without a recourse to fascist armed revolt. In the election campaign after its dismissal, Lang spoke to crowds of 250,000 workers. Seldom had there been such potential to consolidate a mass revolutionary workers' movement. Unfortunately, this opportunity was squandered by the left. I haven't got time to go into that in a lot of detail, but suffice to say, firstly, that the Labor Party left lacked clear politics. The one revolutionary organisation outside the Labor Party that might have seriously influenced and ultimately led this movement was the Communist Party, but it was essentially left incapable and impotent in the wake of Lang's sacking. The Communist Party could not make the most of this potential because of its sectarian approach to labour. The Comintern's third period line, bureaucratically imposed by the Stalinist leadership in the Soviet Union, denounced Labour and Social Democratic parties as social fascists and the greatest enemy of the working class. The Communist Party, now led by Sharkey, Moxon and Miles, followed suit. It cut itself off from other workers who were open to socialist ideas but who were not totally broken with Labour. Rather than seeing socialisation units as potential allies in the fight against capitalism, the Communist Party denounced them as left social fascists. That isn't to say that the Communist Party was entirely impotent. As described above, the Communist Party had organised tens of thousands in the unemployed workers' movement. and in 1929 had initiated the Workers' Defence Cause with the support of the New South Wales Trades and Labour Council. Their purpose had been to coerce strike breakers and defend pickets from police repression during the Hunter Valley coal strike that year. When revived in 1931 with a strong base in the mining town of Lithgow and other branches in Sydney, Newcastle, Brisbane and Perth, its forces were nonetheless not a match for the New Guard. Its members were more often armed with pick handles than revolvers, and it lacked the resources, transport, but most importantly personnel that the New Guard and other fascist secret armies possessed. In 1933, Campbell travelled to Europe and met with fascist leaders in Britain and Germany, including Oswald Mosley and Joachim von Ribbentrop, a lieutenant, I think, to Hitler. He wasn't able to get a meeting with Hitler himself. His 1934 manifesto, The New Road, openly praised Italian dictator Mussolini. Campbell's open embrace of fascism, later recanted, proved too much for many of his fervently pro-British supporters. From 1934 onwards, his movement rapidly declined. Campbell's admiration for European fascism was then widely shared within the Australian establishment. In 1933, the Melbourne Herald ran a series of articles headlined "Why I've Become a Fascist" by Wilfred Kent Hughes, a Victorian MP. Hughes, a former school captain at Melbourne Grammar and a Rhodes Scholar, came from a well-connected Melbourne family. He subsequently became Deputy Premier of Victoria and in the 1950s was a minister in Menzies' federal Liberal government. Menzies, Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister, was also glowing in his praise of Nazi Germany. In 1938, as Attorney General, he visited Germany and on his return gushed about the, and I quote, "really spiritual quality in the willingness of the Germans to devote themselves to the service and well-being of the state." South Australian Premier R.H. Butler visited Germany alongside the State Director of Technical Education and reportedly said that he was especially impressed by the youth labour camps. Other elite figures also expressed praise for Nazi Germany, including Tasmania's right-wing Labour Premier. So Tasmania did have a Labour government in this period. And a prominent old guard leaders, Sir Philip Goldfinch and Sir Robert Gillespie. Nonetheless, capitalist rule had been stabilised without the need for a full-blown fascist regime. The far right and fascist mobilisations had had the desired effect. Australian politics was pushed well to the right. The Conservative governments that came to power federally and in New South Wales shared many of the values of the new and old guard. At least 20 New South Wales members of Parliament had been members of the New Guard, and there were others from the Old Guard too. The Old Guard's front organisation, the All for Australia League, now became the base of the United Australia Party, which under Menzies' leadership was poised to dominate Australian bourgeois politics for decades. The parliamentary arm of the right achieved a lot of what the paramilitary wing desired. Democratic rights were undermined, a harsh censorship regime eroded freedom of speech, and state and federal governments came down heavily on the left, the unions and the unemployed. The coming of the Second World War saw new attacks on civil liberties and the internment of large numbers of German and Southern European emigres. After the war, the Chifley Labor government established ASIO as a national security organisation. Menzies, in turn, greatly increased its surveillance power. In the decades since, Australian capitalism has never faced the level of instability characteristic of the Depression years, and consequently the Australian capitalist class has not had to seriously entertain the idea of a seizure of state power by fascist forces. Nonetheless, the significant growth of proto-fascist forces in Australia in the early 1930s should serve as a warning to us. We must remain ever vigilant and determined to resist the far right and never again allow it to gain such prominence. Thank you.